Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation. Broadcasting live from the Gatehouse here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West in Toronto, or Old Etobicoke, as I always say. Welcome to, we are in July the 6th, I think it's the 6th, I don't even know what day it is. Yes, it is the 6th. But welcome to Personal Transformation. Tonight's going to be, I got lots of different things to talk about tonight. But the main thing I'm going to be talking about tonight, I'm going to be talking about the anxiety of flight, fight, or freeze from childhood sexual abuse. That's primarily what I'm going to be talking about tonight. I'm going to be throwing some information your way, and as well as offering my own experiences with this. And I would encourage if you're on social media through via Twitter, please drop me a line. I am Got to Get Out of the Unforgiven Warrior, if you're unfamiliar with who I am. My name is Stuart Thompson. And like I say, I'm broadcasting live from the Gatehouse here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. So tonight, another thing I'd like to also get swing by you as well. We started another program here tonight, and it is a 15-week program. And I will talk a little bit about it. I haven't really looked into it too much, and I'm really curious to see what it's all about. So I'm going to share with you. So basically, the program is The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but right now, I want to get a couple things out of the way. One, you need to know that I'm not a therapist or anything like that of the sort. I'm only here at a peer level. I'm only offering my own experiences, and also what we do here at the house, my experiences at the house as well, in regards to my healing recovery to where I am now. And also, I need to mention as well that if you are triggered in any way possible, just turn it off. You don't have to listen to me. You can go back later on and listen to it with a friend or when you feel a little bit safer. But heaven's sakes, if whatever I'm talking about may be triggering to you, you know, your self-care is most important. And like I say, you can come back and listen to it later on. And if it really bothers you, I'm not going to be saying anything too crazy triggering, but if I do trigger you, please take some self-care and take care of yourself. If you are in the Toronto area and you are feeling a little triggered, as I'm talking about, and you would like someone to talk to, well, you can call the Gerstein Center, which is downtown Toronto, at 416-929-5200. And if you are in York Region, which is north of Toronto, 905-310-2673. And if you're further down the Eastern Corridor, heading towards Kingston, Belleville, Trenton, Ottawa, Cornwall, even Montreal, you can call 1-800-742-1890. And by the way, the 800 number, you can call anywhere. You can call anywhere from anywhere in Canada. And another local distress line downtown Toronto is 416-408-4357. And if you are of, if you don't want to call there, you can also call RAIN. I also have rain.org posted on my Blog Talk Radio website. And there's a number there you can call at 1-800-656-4674, Canada or the U.S. And there is a website, like I said, as well. So just go to rain.org. And there is a chat line there as well that you can go on. And if you're feeling of distress in any way, your self-care is most important. And you can always come back and listen to this later on. Or not, the choice is yours. But I am going to be talking about flight and freezing and fighting and all kinds of things related to, you know, what could have happened to you as a child and or what you could be dealing with still as an adult. And this topic is a really, really great topic because I have some great personal experiences with this, and I've been fighting with this stuff for years. And what can I say? It's affected me in many, many ways from a very, very young age. And I know that, by the way, I'm going to talk a little bit more about it. I have some information I'm going to pass on to you here as well. I'm going to share. And let me just dig it up here. Now, my information I'm getting from, if you go on to the website of Trauma Recovery, just Google Trauma Recovery, and you will find this. Fight, flight, freeze responses. So I'm going to mention off a bunch of stuff here, and I appreciate any interaction if you choose to do so through Twitter. I'd be quite happy for your input and maybe in your experiences. But well, first off, let's discover what some of these things could be, or let's start off with fight, for example. What are some of the symptoms you could have, or some of the responses, mainly some of the responses you might have? And well, one of them could be crying, hands in the fist, desires to punch, rip. You could flex, tight jaw, grinding teeth, snarl, fight in the eyes, glaring, fight in voice, desire to stomp, kick, smash with legs, feet, feelings of anger, rage, homicidal suicide feelings, knotted stomach, nausea, burning stomach, metamorphosis like bombs, volcanoes erupting. You know, those are the kind of things you could potentially be feeling when as far as fight is concerned. I don't know what you could be feeling, but I know that some of these things here, like if I was to list off something, well, I know years ago, I'd have desire to stomp, kick, smash, that sort of thing with my feet. I know I did it as a child, not even understanding. Well, it could have been probably a couple of different things. It could have been anything from my abuse that was happening to me at the time, to just being plain a bad kid and not getting my way or something like that. But I think it was more towards the abuse, why I behaved like I did. And I know I've made reference to this in the past about this, about how I would react like in a classroom. And it wasn't pretty anyway, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, what else can I say about these things? Well, like I say, it could affect you in many, many different ways. Part of this process to know what works when you're feeling distressed or how to calm yourself. So I'm also going to talk about mindfulness and pause and gratitude and all those other things as well. But let me just read on to this about this. Remember that the objective is not to avoid our feelings, which are not helpful, but rather to acknowledge and honor them. It has been said that pain is unavoidable. Suffering is optional. Suffering comes from trying to avoid feelings, but simply acknowledging what we are feeling is not enough. It is also important to know what we do when we acknowledge them. How to soothe, calm ourselves is so important. How do you comfort and soothe yourself? What practice do you use? Maybe there are culture and spiritual practices you use to help to calm yourself, such as smudging, drumming, chanting or singing, praying, deep breathing, walking, stretching, writing, talking, listening to music, or just a few to say the least that you can do to alter that thought of well, I was talking about fight, about that anger and that sort of stuff. I'm going to talk about the other things as well, but I need to say this as well. To learn more about other practices and easy to learn about techniques calming yourself when you feel anxious and or distressed, well, if you go to this website I'm talking about, again, like I say, Google fight, flight, freeze responses, and you'll find some very, very helpful information in here. There's a video in here as well, and it gives you some options and what some things you can do to help calm yourself when you if you get into that spot. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about, and get back to it here. Well, freeze. Well, I'm going to be bouncing back and forth here, folks. So I'm going to talk about freeze now. Feeling stuck in some part of the body. Feeling cold, frozen, numb, pale skin. Sense of stiffness, heaviness. Holding breath, restricted breathing. Sense of dread, heart pounding. Deceased heart rate, or rather decreased heart rate, can sometimes increase or decrease depending on, in most cases when you're, obviously, when you're in stress, your heart increases. And orientational threat to threat. So now I know that I was just making this comment not too long ago. We were sitting in the kitchen here at the gatehouse, and I was talking with somebody. And what do I do? Well, what did I do when I was triggered in this way? So one example I gave where I would freeze and I would basically go into flight, which I'm going to talk about next. And I'm, like I said, I'm going to be going back and forth on all three of these items here through the evening. But I know when I used to freeze is when I used to, I remember when I was younger, if I was around somebody that was angry and it was directed at me, so what I would do, for example, I don't do that now, but I certainly don't freeze anyway. What I would do is I would freeze, I would clam up, and I would basically, I would go into flight mode. And then I was gone. So that's how I would deal with that, with somebody giving me anger. And probably one of the reasons why I do so the way that I just described for myself was probably from, as a child, my father used to, the only time, well, a lot of times what he would do when he was addressing myself or my younger brother, what he would do, rather than talking to us at a calm, collective, cool manner, he would spend his time shouting and yelling at us. And that was his way of dealing with us children. He really didn't know any other way, but that was his way of doing it. And whenever he would do that, I would go into freeze mode. Even more so after I was sexually abused. And I never really understood why I did that. Or even to this day, I don't really freeze too much anymore. But nevertheless, that's what I would do. That was my way of dealing with that type of, well, orientation threat, as I just described in the last one here. And don't get me, like I've said, I'm only giving you some examples. There's more stuff here you can throw on these lists quite easily. As far as the fight is concerned, and as far as the freeze is concerned, you can add more stuff on here. These are just some examples of how it could affect you, and either it'll affect you, either you can relate to this or you can't relate to this. Okay, now let's talk about flight now a little bit. Russell's legs, feet, numbness in legs, anxiety, shallow breathing, big darting eyes. Leg foot movement, which I quite often do, where my leg and my feet are always moving on. Report or observed frigidness, restlessness, feeling trapped, tense, a sense of running in life, one active activity next, excessive exercise. Well, I used to do that too. That was my way of coping. Another way of running I would do is like I would play football, for example, or soccer if you're here in North America. But I would run. That was my way of dealing with all that. You know, when I was playing football or soccer, that was my distraction. I did that from when I was doing martial arts. I did that for many, many years. And actually, I still play it here where I'm living here in Toronto now, along with baseball once a week. Granted, I don't look at it like I'm describing to you now, but it was my way of running. And it was my way of dealing with my stress or my pain. And another thing I would do for flight is what I would do in flight is whenever I get into a situation where I was badly triggered from my childhood past, I would, I would freeze and then I would go into flight mode, as I've been describing. And when I went into flight mode, sometimes what I would do is I would shut everybody out. I would isolate. And I would isolate myself so well that I wouldn't communicate with anybody. And that was my way of dealing with what was going on. And it didn't matter whether I was in an intimate relationship or it was a fight with a friend or It didn't really matter. As long as it was directed at me and I felt threatened, and this may be where you can relate, it doesn't necessarily mean, even as an adult, when I get triggered, and maybe where you can relate to this, where you would fall back and it would put you right back into that time where you were abused. I know that as an example of what I'm talking about, right, when I made the example about my father, I know that I was being abused, and then when he'd yell at me, that would just made it worse tenfold. And I would definitely go into flight mode. I was gone. I remember I can think of a few times where my father wanted to kick my ass because I was a bad kid. He would never find me because I was gone. Well, probably one obviously, reason is I didn't want him kicking my butt. Scared the hell out of me. Because he was such a huge man and very, very powerful man. A huge, huge man. And I wouldn't want him, like my grandfather, getting a hold of me, as I've talked about in the past. So I would disappear. And he'd never find me. The only way he'd ever talk to me was on the phone. And even then I was pretty minimal too, because I wouldn't always talk to him on the phone. So, okay. So I gave you three examples of fight, freeze, and flight. Now, again, these examples are coming from traumarecovery.ca. So I noticed when I Googled it, there's many different sites that offer many different things and observations in regards to these three things I'm talking about. And, you know, when you're a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, it can be, well, it affects us in many different ways. I mean, what I mean by many different ways, it affects everybody differently. So how it affects me may not affect you, is what I'm saying. Everyone has the right to present a future that they are not completely dominated and dictated to by the past. And that's a quote by Karen, I can't even say her name. Karen, what's wrong with me? I'm talking about being tongue-tied, twisted. I just don't want to pronounce your name incorrectly. Sakviniti, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which I know I'm not. I sound really silly and foolish here right at the moment. But anyway, that's a quote at the bottom of the page. And I tend to agree with that. Everyone has the right to have a present and a future that are not completely dominated and dictated by the past. Absolutely. I mean, I know from experience that whenever I got into those modes, what I'm talking about, that's what I would do. I would do as I just described. I would freeze, and I would get into flight mode, and I was gone, or I'd isolate myself. I would do all kinds of different things. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. Actually, no. Let me change what I'm trying to say here. Okay. I know that now. I look at myself and I look at these things now, like for example, like for a flight, for example, and I look at freeze. Well, I don't really freeze a whole lot now. I sometimes might be triggered and go into flight mode, which I'm going to talk a little bit about here right now, which I've been struggling with for quite a while. You know, I often talk about, again, trigger warning here. I talk about suicide and I talk about, or rather, I have talked about suicide, and I've also talked about how it affected me personally. And obviously, you know whoever listens to me and follows me on Twitter and Facebook and follows the radio show knows that I do assist training. Well, that can be very, very triggering too as well. And I know that whenever I go and do it, I don't have to sit for a half hour and meditate before I go and doing it. I've dealt with it so many times, and I seem to be quite comfortable with dealing with it, and it doesn't seem to affect me in the way that I thought that it would affect me, especially by hearing other people's stories. And I don't know why that is. Actually, I do know why that is, and so I've been told, but nevertheless, I do it. But I guess what I'm trying to get at here, without sounding like I'm running around in a circus here right now, what I'm trying to say is that what happens to me is that when I get into that flight mode, as I've been feeling for quite a while. And the funny thing about it is I have lots of reasons why I shouldn't go into flight mode. I have lots of positive reasons why I don't need to run away. For what I'm doing here at the Gatehouse, I mean, that's a really good example of what I'm doing here. One reason why I don't need to run away or to get into flight mode when I am triggered. I have that support here. But this is really what I'm getting at, and this is where maybe people might understand where I'm coming from, and maybe you don't feel very comfortable talking about it. Well, I don't feel very comfortable talking about it either, but I really think it needs to be said, so I'm just going to go ahead and say it, because it's bothered me for quite a while, and I've been holding on to this for quite a while, and we talk about flight mode. Well, my flight mode or thoughts regarding flight mode what I've been feeling personally, especially this last while, well, I've got every reason why I don't like to hear, I'm going to use this word, which I don't like using, why I should stay, or rather I could stay. I have lots of positive reasons why I could stay and want to be around and keep doing what I'm doing. But my problem is I've always had that flight mode in my body. And having body trauma like I've been carrying this last while, it's just been awful. You know, I've been fighting this, and I've been talking about this and thinking that my body pain or my body trauma is disappearing. Well, it comes and goes, and some days it's worse than others. I have realized that I think that it has gotten better, but I still carry it. So therefore, it's still there. So what I'm getting at by saying is that in these last couple of months, I've been really, really struggling in flight mode. And what I mean by that is I've got all these things very, very positive in front of me, but to myself, they seem insignificant, they seem unimportant, and irrelevant to really what I'm feeling. And what I mean by that, too, is that I, just so you get a better understanding of what I'm thinking and feeling, and hopefully you might even be able to relate to this as well, I'm basically feeling that I just want to get the hell out of Dodge. And out of layman's terms or blue-collar terms, I just want to leave town. Like, I just want to leave. Just like that. That's simple. But I can't. I want to. And I just want to walk away from everything, but I can't. And it's not because when I say I can't, there's lots of reasons why I can't. Well, one, really most important, okay, is that I really don't want to. I just have that thought process in my head. And whenever I'm feeling challenged, or I'm feeling triggered, or I'm, well, just plain being challenged, personally, whether it's be for my challenge in a way of, let's say, well, whether it be work, gatehouse, at home, many, many different things. And but you know, I got this thing going around inside me telling me, Stu, get the hell out of Dodge. Like, don't stay here. Don't do this anymore. But I stay here because really deep down, and with my mindfulness that I practice to myself, which I've been practicing for a long time, is helping me to stay here, to be present, and to be, well, somewhat focused. It's really hard to focus when you're distracted and when you want to just leave, when you just want to leave. And you don't want really, you know, like, I've been fighting really, really hard for years to be where I am. And I guess to put it in a way you really understand is that it's really hard. You know, like, yes, I practice mindfulness, and yet it's so easy to fall back into that trap and say, you know what, I've had enough. I just want to go. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm tired. I feel like I'm not winning. I feel like I'm still battling an uphill battle. I feel like I'm not getting any further. I'm not progressing. Well, the truth of the matter is I am. And it's all that statement that I just made. It's very, very frustrating sometimes knowing that you're going to feel that way. And yet, if it wasn't for my practice of mindfulness that I've done for myself, there's no way that I would be able to do what I'm doing here now. Absolutely not. Whatever form of mindfulness I might be practicing at the time has allowed me to be here and do what I'm doing. And of course, my own drive to want to change better for myself. Now, this didn't come easy, not whatsoever. You know, like mindfulness, I had to practice and practice and practice and practice. So that basically I don't have to carry those feelings. It's like when I used to have flashbacks, for example, or I would have a bad nightmare, I would go into flight mode so fast. People have no idea. Well, maybe if you've been through this experience, you probably can definitely relate to what I'm talking about. But whenever I used to have flashbacks and nightmares, and granted, I still get flashbacks. I don't have the nightmares as often as I used to. That's probably because I still not a pretty good sleeper, but nonetheless, they're not as bad as they used to be. And that's only because I've been dealing with everything that happened to me as a child. And that's really the beginning of it, is really what my answer to what I'm thinking to myself is. That's really the beginning of how I've changed to be mindful like I am now, where I'm able to talk about it openly and freely about what I'm thinking and feeling and where I'm going, and knowing that, yeah, I'm feeling that way, but I'm not going to do it, though. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to be present. And I'm not going to run away, or I'm not going to flight. And those things were not easy things to learn. It took a lot of practice on my part. And, you know, I still disbelieve myself when I see something really good in front of me. I don't believe sometimes that it's actually good. I still believe that sometimes that it's not good. So therefore, when I see that, then the first thing I'm going to do is fall back onto flight. But learning this, or rather being aware of these things, is key to understanding what you're thinking and feeling. If you're aware, then you can find ways of coping with this in a more positive manner. Well, now I'm talking about it here in front of all you out there listening, but it's still not that simple. When I'm done here, well, I'm still going to be left with it. And granted, I'm not really going to be left with it because I pointed out in the beginning, I have lots of support. So it's not like I'm alone. And it's not like I can't find other people out there going through this that have done the same thing. And knowing how to cope with it and knowing how to deal with it, or rather knowing how to deal with it in a positive manner is so key. One thing we can think about that makes us, you know, one thing I have to recognize about myself is that I have resilience. You know, and if you don't understand the definition of resilience, it's the understanding of resilience from an individual concept. Popular to Western trained researchers and human resources provides is to a more culturally embedded understanding of well-being understood this way. Resilience is a social construct that identifies both processes and outcomes and associated with the people themselves term well-being. It makes explicit that the resilience is more likely to occur when we provide the services to support the health resources to make it more likely than every other child will do well in the ways of meaningful to his or her family and community. There are many factors in associated with resilience. Some are more common aspects of successful navigation and negotiation for well-being under stress, including the following. Well, for example, one thing is being important, which I've kind of pointed out to myself in moving forward is my own self-determination or my own self-assertiveness in discovering that I'm, you know, that I'm struggling and then having that support group really help. The ability to solve problems, self-efficiency, the ability to live in uncertainty, self-awareness, a positive outlook, empathy from others, that's where the support comes in. Having goals and aspirations, the ability to maintain a balance between independence and dependence on others, to appropriate use of or abstinence from substance like alcohol and drugs. A sense of humor comes in really handy sometimes. A sense of duty to tell others or self, depending on the culture. Here's some common factors. Opportunities for age-appropriate work, avoidance of exposure to violence in one's family, community, and with peers. Government provisions for children's safety, recreation, housing, and jobs when they are at the appropriate age to work, of course, meaning when you're like at least a teenager anyway, meaningful rites of passage with an appropriate amount of risk, tolerance of high risk and problem behavior, safety and security, perceived social equality, access to school and education, information and learning resources. Here's talk a little bit about cultural factors. Affiliation with religious organization, tolerance for different ideologies and beliefs, adequate management of culture discoloration and change or shift in values, self-betterment, having a life philosophy, culture and spiritual identification, being culturally grounded by knowing where you come from and being part of cultural tradition, what is expressed through daily activities. And finally, physical ecology factors. Access to healthy environment, security in one's community, access to recreational spaces, sustainable resources, ecological diversity for more, okay, yes. And so those are some, we're going to go back to where I was here. So for resilience, in order to further define resilience, looking to these resources, as I just pointed out, for help is really, really important. Now, if you're on this webpage, I really recommend you check this video out. It's only 2 minutes and 30 seconds, two minutes long, but you'll have a better understanding of to what more I'm talking about, and maybe it might help you understand as well in regards to what you're thinking and feeling yourself. Okay, now what else can I cover here to make sure I've got this? Okay, so let's talk about a triangle of well-being. Again, I'm quoting this from traumarecovery.ca. Okay. Let me see what I can pass on. This here is very, very important. Okay, everyone has the right to have a present and a future. They are not completely... Okay, well, I've already said that already. What's wrong with me? Okay. Okay, in the article that talks about this, the triangle of well-being and resilience, the model developed by Dr. Dan Siegel, 2010, demonstrates how the thoughts of experience literally shape the physiological connections between the various parts of our brain. The arrows, if you look in the diagram, if you go to the website, Dr. Siegel's model below points in every direction. Each point, a triangle interacts with each other two to create continuous feedback loops. The model illustrates our mind and our brain and relationships as part of an open system that is continuously responding to new experiences. This capacity for change, neuroplasticity, is a new idea, but not too long ago, scientists were able to ascertain one's basic structure of the brain formed in childhood and physical reworking of reconnections to the brain in the brain was impossible. Now, if you go to YouTube and remember, I was talking about mindfulness. You go to YouTube and you type in Dr. Jeffrey Swartz. He talks about mindfulness. And here's a doctor who's, it's a great video to watch. And this is what I've been saying. I've been using to help me with my fight, flight, and freeze. And amongst other things that I've used this for as well. But for this, for these particular things, that's what I've been using for that. And I can't really talk about it unless I've tried it myself. So when I say that I've tried it and I'm still trying it, that means I still am. So I can't talk about something unless I've actually tried it. And I am trying it and I practice it all the time. So like I say, if you go to YouTube or TED Talks, actually TED Talks, and you talk and you type in Dr. Jeffrey Swartz and or the four steps of mindfulness, this will be where I'm coming from right now as I'm talking about. Now, if you're on the a computer, and actually, if you know, I can't really show the diagram on here, but someday I'll be able to do that. But I will talk about mindfulness too a little more in depth. Dr. Siegel goes further to say that the mind, our thoughts and our feelings can and do interact with the physical nervous system to influence how we respond to experiences throughout our lives. What we intend to pay attention to directs and regulates electrically, chemically signals so that the physical changes can be detected with scans that measure activity. If you're looking at this chart, you would know as well, but they're able to chart these things as I'm talking about, as Dr. Siegel describes. The mind regulates the flow of energy and the information to the nervous system. Now, this conference that he talks about this, he was a keynote speaker back in Winnipeg, Manitoba, 2012. And again, I would encourage you to go into this article. And if you're trying to figure out what's going on with yourself, these are key to practicing mindfulness. Or rather, I shouldn't say there's so much that they're key, but key to having an understanding to how it works and how your brain works. When I talk about neuroplasticity, now if you go to TED Talks, as I was talking about, and Dr. Jeffrey Swartz talks about neuroplasticity on a more depth level other than what I'm describing it here now. Relationships are part of this model because our form is to view the world through interactions with our parents, caregivers, teachers, friends, and a larger community. The relationships, especially with caregivers, are our earliest months, have a profound effect on how our brain develops and what our mind will be preoccupied with. Our internalized experience of these interactions with our caregivers will be the template that informs, often unconsciously, our relationships throughout our life. This is a model mind-brain relationships to co-involve to make up who we are. This is particularly true when we are babies. It is our earliest relationships that lay down the blueprint for our development brain, for our developing brain. The study of parental influence on young children's development has been explored through viewing the results of various forms of parent-infant bonding and attachment theory by Bowlby, 1988. This is a rich area of research that includes many variations, but for the purpose of this course, we'll focus on the two broad forms. Which I'm going to talk about here now. Okay, I'm going to talk about secure attachment. A secure attachment occurs when a caregiver is attentive to the needs of the baby. The parent recognizes the baby's signals for hunger and simple biological needs, but also responds to the emotional signal from the baby for attention. A cuddle of soothing after the upset, like falling down when learning to walk, it's not necessarily that every need be met. But the most of the time, the baby has growing sense that if she needs help, help will come. Over the course of childhood, this security allows the development of the brain to build a good connections between the prefrontal cortex, reasoning part of the brain, with the mind-brain structures, which are involved in sensing emotions and their regulation according to the memory, achieving body awareness, and developing empathy. So all these things are very, very, very important. Okay, now, the next, post-traumatic growth. The focus on strengths instead of weaknesses on a basic tent of recovery. So, okay, now, I've kind of been talking about mindfulness a little bit, but now I'm gonna go into a little bit more, but let's talk about a little bit about post-traumatic growth. Again, I'm quoting from the from traumarecovery.ca. Focusing on strengths instead of weaknesses is a basic tenet of recovery. However, people who have experienced trauma, this can be very difficult and a part of what is wounded in the trauma. There is a tendency to see themselves as inherently weak due to their inexperiences, beginning to see yourself from the strength-based perspective as part of the process toward healing. Um, Yes. Shifting your view toward view of trauma as an injury shifts the perspective belief away from the sickness to the impact and moves the conversation away from what is going on with you to what is happening with you. So I guess basically what they're saying, and if you don't understand or what I'm saying or what I'm reading to you, is what they're saying is, remember I talked about being aware. Well, this is what I'm talking about. This is about awareness. This is about being, you know, being understand. Well, seeing what you're thinking and feeling. So when you get in that flight mode, or freeze mode, or fight mode, is being able to recognize that, and saying, okay, I'm gonna tilt here, or I'm gonna fly away, I'm gonna run away, I'm gonna go into the fight. You know, recognizing that right off the hop is so important. It is also important to have awareness, as I just pointed out. People who have experienced trauma can go out, what has been identified in the literature, as I've talked about in post-traumatic growth, understanding that this is possible, it is an important element contributes to fostering hope. The research suggests that between the ages of between 30 to 70% of individuals who've experienced trauma also report positive change and growth coming out of traumatic experience. They're quoted by Joseph and Butler, 2010. Post-traumatic growth is defined as an experience of individuals whose development, at least in some areas, has surpassed what was present before. The struggle comes with crisis. Occurred, the individual has not only survived, but has experienced changes that are viewed as important and that go beyond the status quo. Individuals have described profound changes in their view of relationships, how they view themselves, and their philosophies in life. What is essential to keep in mind is that the post-traumatic growth is not a direct result of trauma, but rather related to how the individual struggles as a result of the trauma. So basically what that the statement there is saying is that basically, so those things that like fight, flight, freeze, are all the result of what happened to when we had a trauma. Okay, where am I here again? Okay. Okay, it is important not to minimize the impact of the trauma in effect to promote the post-traumatic stress, or rather post-traumatic growth. This is not always the outcome for individuals who have experienced trauma. It is important not to apply any failure or minimize the impact of the trauma. It is also important to be aware that even the presence and development of post-traumatic growth, it doesn't mean that there is an absence of distress. Both can occur simultaneously. Post-traumatic growth can be considered an outcome as well as a process. It is about maintaining a sense of hope that not only can a person who has experienced trauma survive, but they can also experience the positive life changes as a result. Keeping in mind, it is not the event that defines the post-traumatic growth, but what is able to develop from within the person and the service provides can play a significant role in this process. So basically, everyone struggles in life at one time or another, and life's journeys as many ups and downs, twists and turns. Life is never straight, even a path, and even may require an occasional detour to get wherever you want to go be in life. Whether you have experienced traumatic events or not, most of us have. We all have experienced or not. Most of us have. We all have experienced times, but when we doubt ourselves, we are fearful, uncertain, and feel inadequate. This is a part of being human. Trauma is an effect of our mental health, but it doesn't mean we are crazy, sick, or ill. Remember, trauma is an injury that happens to us. Many think that mental health is simple absence of mental illness. Mental health is a mental illness. However, two very different things. Mental health is a very sense of well-being that comes from knowing that you can cope with whatever life sends our way. Mental health is about equality of life and finding balance between all aspects of our lives. Social, physical, spiritual, and emotional, the World Health Organization defines mental health as a state of well-being in which the individual realizes that his or her own potential can cope with the normal stresses of life. Normal stresses of life can work productively and fruitfully and is able to make a contribution of her or his own to the community. This Public Health Agency of Canada, for example, defines mental health as being a capacity of each other, us, to feel, think, and act in the ways to enhance our ability to enjoy life and deal with the challenges we face. It is possible to sense of an emotional and spiritual well-being that respects the importance of cultural equality and social justice, interconnections, and personality and personal dignity. Good mental health can actually prevent mental illness. It is understandable that that when we experience traumatic events, we can feel less confidence in our ability to cope with whatever life throws at us. You might feel more guarded, less trusted, less sure to yourself and of others. It can change the way you view, interact with the world around you. This can affect your sense of mental health, disrupt your sense of life balance. Your confidence is connection with others and the interference with your quality of life. While it can feel crazy making it, but doesn't mean you are crazy, your reactions and feelings are normal reactions to abnormal events. You survive these traumatic events because your strengths you have and your internal and external resources you could access. Remember, this also took courage. Recovering from the effects of trauma and enhancing your mental health is about understanding and knowing the strengths of knowing yourself. No one has the perfect mental health, and anyone can do these things to improve their mental health. It is a long journey that gets easier as you travel down the road you have already started. You are actually farther down the road than you actually might think. But besides, you're listening to me right now talking about this, so you are listening, you are trying to do something. Dr. Corey Keyes describes the three types of well-being: emotional, physical, and social well-being. We will also include a spiritual vocabulary. Actually, let me see. Do I read these? Okay. Well, yeah. You know what? I think I will. And then I'm also think I'm going to talk about the four steps of mindfulness. I'm also going to cover that about as well. I talked about where you can go on to Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz from TED Talks, and he talked about four steps of mindfulness. Well, I'm going to go a little bit further into this, and I want to make sure that I haven't covered anything here. And make sure I've covered everything here. And okay, I think what I'm going to do right now is I think I'm just going to jump right into the four steps of mindfulness. So let me just dig this out. Again, I would recommend that you go to traumarecovery.ca. And you will find this information that I've been talking about, and actually I've been reading to you about this, and I guarantee it will be somewhat helpful in helping you trying to figure out what the heck's going on with yourself. Okay, let me just grab this. You'd think I'd have it memorized already, but I have it right here. Just bear with me a second here. I have it right here. Okay. Now, I know I've talked about this lots of times before, but this is perfect time to talk about it now, because when you get into these three forms of, well, the anxiety of fight, flight, or freezing, this is where the four steps of mindfulness really comes in handy. I know this is where it's helped me immensely many, many, many times. And I'm just going to read them off to you. And the idea is, actually, if you go onto our website, I'm pretty sure that we have it posted there. And you can write it down and try practicing it yourself. I would really recommend you try to do that. And, you know, I'm also keeping in mind, too, that it may not work for you as well, but at least give it a try to see if it does help you. And if it doesn't, then find something else that might work for you. Okay. Well, first off, let me make sure I got the right one here. Make sure I'm telling you the right stuff. Okay. No, I've only looked at this book about 1,000 times now. And you think I know where it is? Yes. I was talking about neuroplasticity. Okay. Here we are. Now, the four steps. Where are we? Yes, here we are. Okay. Let me just blast this. Oh, that's something new. Okay, well, I guess I can retweet this. I just realized I know they've changed all the format here on Blog Talk Radio, so I'm going to have to fix that. Okay. Four Steps to Mindfulness. This is by Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz. And this is what I use for myself to help me to get where I am today. Like, for example, like what I was telling you in the beginning of the program. I've been constantly thinking for weeks now, I want to get the hell out of here. I want to leave. And I have really no reason why I could, or rather I should. I don't even like using that word should. You know, we think about should around the gatehouse. We should all over ourselves. Well, I should stay, but I should leave. Well, what am I going to do? How am I going to decide for myself? Am I just going to be indecisive and go? Am I going to stay? Well, no, I think I'm going to stay. I have lots of reasons why I should, why I could stay, or I want to stay. You know, when you think like that, like I'm talking about, it's very hard to go back and think about the reason, the positive reasons why I should stay, or I shouldn't go into flight mode. But when I'm feeling like I am, when I have that body trauma inside of me and I'm feeling like I am, none of that really, really matters. If you're dealing with this sort of thing, like I'm talking about, that body pain you're feeling inside, for example, that body pain I'm talking about, I feel inside me, I've had it for years and it gets pretty unbearable sometimes. And, you know, I describe some of the other things, like such as tapping of the feet and doing that. I mean, to me, that's minor. That's nothing. But the pain I'm feeling inside, granted, I'm not feeling that right now. In these last few weeks, I've been getting it off and on. And for some reason, the last few days, it's been really, really, really bad. But my point, what I'm trying to get at, which was, yes, I'm talking about the four steps of mindfulness. And this is where I've been applying this. So this is what's been helping me to stay here. And thank God for my roommate, for example, and a few other good people that I have that are around me in my life that help me, because I'm telling you, I'd be gone without a second thought. And I have all the reasons why I shouldn't leave, you know, and here I am using the word shouldn't or should. I have lots of reasons why I shouldn't leave, but yet I want to, and that thought process, like I talked about suicide, is a constant thought in my head, you know, and And I know that I'm not going to go through with it. It's just the thought is there. Well, you know, it's kind of like I have a little battle going on inside my brain where, you know, I have one side of me telling me, Stu, you're such a bad person, bad, bad person. But I'm not a bad person. I know that. But yet I have the little person knocking on my head here and my door here. You know, the little red guy with the pointy ears and smoke blowing out his ass. That guy is knocking on my door telling me, Stu, you know, you go that way. Well, lucky for me, I've got a little more support and strength from the other side. And by applying these four steps of mindfulness, this has helped me keep this guy out. I mean, that's a crazy analogy, but that's really what's going on in my head. I don't want, you know, I want to go, but I don't. I know that's very self-contradicting and contradicting, period, as far as that's concerned, and I would think in anyone's mind. But nevertheless, I'm here and I'm talking about it. So that says a lot, I know, about that I'm not gone. I'm here, I'm present, and I'm aware. And see, when you know, I fall back when I talk about awareness. You see, that's really, really key. You know, I may go into this, I may have that person knocking on my door in my head, but I don't answer the door because I'm already aware that that person is there. And I know that if I open up that door, then I know I'm going to be gone. So being aware and understanding these things and like all those things I've talked about from that article, or rather from that, from traumarecovery.ca. And then don't get me wrong, there's other sites on there as well. And these are only Canadian findings, but they are very, very helpful. It was very helpful. It was a good read anyway, that's for sure. Okay, well, let's start off with the four steps of mindfulness. Well, number one is to relabel. Determine the observed thought as the false belief as not really a need. For example, I have to go to the market to purchase a bag of chips right now. The person begins to believe that he or she instantly requires to have a bag of chips at this particular moment. Okay, well, there you go. That's my example. I could have said something else, but that's step number one. Step number two. In this step, you identify that your mind is sending you an untrue signal, kind of like what I was talking about. I gave you an analogy of that guy knocking on my head in the door. You know, the guy with the, you know, little red guy with the pointy ears there saying, Stu, come on, let's get out. Come on, come in through my door. That's the guy I'm talking about. The signal attempts to make you believe that you have an actual need to carry out that thought or behavior associated with that thought. Say to yourself that these thoughts, urges and impulses to keep bothering you, and that they are false brain messages. This makes you realize that you do not have to actually need to carry out that thought or behavior. It's just your brain sending you a false message or signal. Clearly, you may carry out that thought, I have to go to the store to buy that bag of chips, as it is triggered by a stressful event, such as childhood structural abuse trauma. You are not accountable for these events happen to you, but you are now accountable for the decisions you are currently make and your actions you carry out. So if you go and you get this bag of chips or something else, it doesn't have to be that, it could be drugs, alcohol, as a form of coping. You know, it doesn't have to be a bag of chips. Could be drugs, alcohol, like I said. Could be sex addiction. It could be anything. You know, and some addictions are good for you and some addictions are bad for you. Well, I guess you really define what you mean by good. I can't say that a bag of chips is good for you, but I know it's less harmful for you than hard drugs or alcohol. But over a period of time, like anything, I guess it would be bad for you as well. Okay. I talked about one and two. Let's go to three now. Step three is about refocusing. In this step, you try to concentrate on something else to do when you're having this particular thought to allow for a certain period of time to pass. Let's say 5 to 15 minutes. It's not how you feel that counts, It's what you do, for example. If you need to drive the car to the casino to turn on the TV, you need to watch television to put on some music. If you need to buy music to get on your exercise bike, well, if you to refocus, those are some things and that you can do. And then instead of the bag of chips, well, you can go for a bike ride, or you can put some music on, or you can eat celery sticks and carrots versus a bag of chips. I know that sounds kind of boring and not very exciting, of course, in comparison to the bag of chips. But it'd be much more healthy for you. Much more healthy for you. So by refocusing, what I mean, if you haven't figured it out already, is basically coming up with something else versus with that original thought of maybe running away, like I was talking about, or being compulsive and buying that bag of chips because you are feeling that you're feeling that type of anxiety where you need to do something to cope, and that bag of chips may help you cope, then that bag of chips may help you cope. Okay, last but not least, step number 4. In this step, you are consciously aware of your thoughts and why they are occurring. With this new awareness, you will be able to make better choices in your life that will benefit you. So if you do these 4, I'll read them real quickly again. Relabel. Determine, observe the thought as a false belief and not really a need. For example, I have to go to the market to purchase a bag of chips. Number 2, reattribute. In this step, you identify that your mind is sending you an untrue signal. The signal attempts that you make, you believe that you have actually need to carry out the thought or behavior associated with that thought. Say to yourself these thoughts, excuse me, urges and impulses to keep bothering you and that they are false brain messages. This makes you realize you do not have the actual need to carry out the thought or behavior. Your brain is sending you false signal. Number 3, refocus. In this step, you try to concentrate on something else to do when you're having that thought, particularly about allowing, and also this allows you this thought to pass by. Give yourself 5-10 minutes, and in that 5-10 minutes, while you're refocusing, find something else to focus on. Can it be a bag of chips or a really, really good Pink Floyd album? That's what I'd be doing. I would go with the Pink Floyd album. And what would I pick? Well, actually, really hard because I like them all. So anyway, okay, so finally, number 4. In this step, the last step, you are consciously aware of your thoughts and why they are occurring. So with this new awareness that you've got, this is basically your stepping stone for moving on to another thought process. Such as instead of buying a bag of chips, as I've been making that analogy, you can go and play music, Pink Floyd, like I just suggested. You could go to the fridge and get something more healthy, like instead of buying a bag of chips, buy some fruit, buy some vegetables, buy something that's more healthy for you. And you will probably feel much better by having that anyway after you have that, instead of feeling fat and bloated after you've had the salty chips and maybe the dip to go along with it. Granted, they were very, very good, but eating it because of trauma is not really good. If you're going to eat the bag of chips, all I would suggest to that, and I'd be the first one to admit to say that, well, of course I like chips. And just because I had an impulse to go buy chips because of a past trauma thought that I had in my head going on, it's not a good reason to go buy the chips. I'd much rather go buy a bag of chips and dip, for example. Here's a great example. Going out and you're out with a bunch of people and friends, for example, or you're with some people you care about and you're having fun. Now, to me, that's a much better example to go buy a bag of chips. Not because you're feeling like a bag of crap and nobody cares, you don't care about yourself, and that may be the thought you have going through your head at that time, but no. Save your bag of chips for some good company. But if you're feeling bad, find some beautiful music to put on. to help your to help console your soul. Eat some. When you're doing enough to eat vegetables, that's pretty, really boring. But I know fruit can be pretty exciting. I know you can go and buy these fruit trays with all these different types of fruit on them, and that'd be much more better for your body versus all that salt and saturated fats to make you feel worse after the fact. So remember, please try to remember that our thoughts are connected to our feelings, and our feelings govern our actions. In order to effective and total personal transformation to occur, it is vital for you to make decisions about who you want to be in your life after all. Decisions will make today affect our lives tomorrow. Our thoughts are connected to our feelings, and our feelings are govern our actions. So when we, I gave some great examples of what you could do or you couldn't do, but I know that I gave you a great example tonight of, well, do I stay? Should I stay or should I go? The bottom line is I guess I'm going to stay because I'm here now, and I've practiced these four steps of mindfulness as I've just described. And granted, I don't practice it in the way I've just described it, but I am aware, and I'm always aware of even when I get into a slump and where I have this body pain, it's very, very, very difficult it's gotten easier, but it is difficult to change that thought process, and it does take a lot of practice. So, folks, if you're out there listening, and hopefully I didn't trigger you in any way, this is one way of helping you to cope with those thoughts that I've talked about. So, finding meditation is another thing you could do as well if you're able to do that. A really good walk is really, really handy. I like a brisk walk. I know. Something to really, really take your brain off those thoughts. A bag of chips is really nothing, but if you're thinking of your childhood, of your past childhood sexual abuse that you've experienced and how that's affected you, I mean, you could be suffering from PTSD, CPTSD. You could be suffering from these two forms of post-traumatic stress, and it affects us really, really differently and weirdly, and it takes a lot of years to be aware of what you're thinking and feeling, and sometimes you may even need to go see someone who knows about this, such as a psychotherapist or someone who specializes in this to help you, to give you kind of like a guiding path to go along that you can do certain things to help yourself, to give yourself self-help, to get yourself out of that mode. I think I've pretty much talked myself out of this now, and I really needed to say what I've said in regards to, not just what I'm thinking and feeling in regards to myself, but in regards to the whole topic in general. And I think I've pretty much talked it out, and now I think I'd like to move on to another topic, and that is a new program that we've started at the Gatehouse, and that is which the two participants the two facilitators that organized this that set this up is called The Road from Estrangement to Reconciliation. Now, I really looked at this book a whole lot, and I'm going to tell you what it's all about. I'm not going to go through the whole book, but I will tell you what it consists of. It is a 15-week program, and this is the stuff that they're going to be talking about. So the kind of things you're going to be talking about the pain from estrangement, the roots of estrangement. That's just in the first week, which is tonight. Okay, week two, building a self, importance of anatomy of boundaries, learning about boundaries again when injuries are unforgivable, the difference between reconciliation and capitalization. Week three, finding clarity, acknowledging our injuries. Week four, taking the first steps. What risks do you face pursuing reconciliation at this time? How to overcome your fears. Taking the first steps. And they also talk about self-care in here as well. Week five, persistence over time. Don't sweat the small stuff. Creating a new future together. How committed are you? Week six, communication that furthers the closeness. Types of communication, learning to listen. Week seven, recognizing our shared humanity, finding compassion. Disconcernment with the heart. Compassion begins with acceptance. Growing with compassion. 6 steps to change revenge to compassion. Week 8. Taking responsibility for estrangement. Part 1. Estrangement when it does not involve the perpetrator. Acknowledging your own weaknesses. My part in the estrangement. Learning to apologize. The healing of accountability. Part 2, estrangement from the perpetrator. Week 9, questions of forgiveness. Forgiveness is something you work at. Forgiveness, a spiritual gift. Forgiveness, something that requires accountability. The trouble with procedural forgiveness are some things unforgivable. Week 10, when reconciliation is impossible, the task of letting go, accepting that the relationship is over when you are responsible for the estrangement, leaving the porch light on, the inner revolution of when you cannot reconcile with your abuser. Week 11, 12, and 13. Week 11, getting started. Week 12, getting the heart of the matter, telling your story. Week 13, staying on track. Week 14, the benefits of reconciliation after estrangement. Reweaving the web of the family and community. Reconciliation, kindness, optimism. Reconciliation leads to peace. So those, and then of course week 15, which will be a potluck. So those are some of the topics that... Well, actually, those are all the topics they'll be covering. And let me see if there's anything else here I can tell you in here. I can't tell you everything, but let's just look through it here and see. Because this would be a great topic as well. In fact, is the two facilitators that are doing this have agreed to come down and talk about this group, which they've started. And they agreed to come out about week 6. So this is just the first week. It's the 15 weeks. So in 5 weeks, I'll have them come in and we'll talk about this new program that's offered at the Gatehouse. Okay. Okay. Let me see if there's anything here that I can pass on. Well, there's lots here I can pass on, but I don't want to give it all away. Well, here's something I could read that I think is very it would be very substantial to what was being said today. Healing power of accountability. Saying the words, "I'm sorry, I regret what I did, I can see how it affected you," is part of the apology. The words alone are not enough. To have meaning, it must accompany the consistent change of behavior. When one person is in a relationship, constantly breaks down promises, fails to listen or is disrespectful, simply saying you are sorry is not enough. The person needs to change their behavior. When both parties have played a role in creating a rift, they are both need to acknowledge their part of what went wrong. Estrangement based on misunderstanding, judgment, or a stubborn refusal to say you are sorry or you were wrong can often be reminded of one or both people relinquishing their pride. Getting bogged down in who started it or who was the most at fault does not matter, and it is often reinforces the feelings of estrangement. Instead, humility and an attitude of generosity is necessary. The more quickly this happens when things start to go wrong again, the more favorable their reconciliation. There's much different dynamic, and the estrangement is rooted in a deeper violations in which one person has committed a terrible wrong against the other. The victim of incest, abandonment, or battering does not own the perpetrator anything, and you don't need to meet the perpetrator halfway. Well, that's interesting. Okay. Oh, here's one. Here's some stuff that could be pretty interesting as well. What I mean by interesting, when I say that, I make that comment. These are great topics that they're talking about here, and it would be a great. I would love to do the program. It's 15 weeks long, and it's on Thursday nights. Unfortunately, it falls in my radio show, but I think I will at some point do that at some point. And as I'm speaking here, I have Mr. Paul Dunn coming in, our coordinator for the men's program and partners program, or rather. Phase two program has just come in and brought me a coffee.
That's right. Coffee delivery, sir.
Thank you. You want to chat for a minute?
Yeah, sure. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing excellent. So what I've been talking about here, Paul,
yeah.
is I've been talking about fight, flight. Well, the anxiety of flight or flight or freeze or all those
freeze,
things.
Fight,
everybody reacts differently to those sort of things.
That's
so. True. I cover, and I've also quoted from tremorrecovery.ca today as well, where I got all my information from. And I also offered my own affirmations of what I would do whenever I got into that flight mode. And one of the things I talked about tonight is that I've been, in the last few weeks, I've been in this constant thought mode of getting the hell out of here.
Right.
You know, but with my practice of mindfulness,
right.
that has allowed me to not to pursue that.
Right.
Or to continue on with those, or rather to follow through with those thoughts.
Okay. That's wonderful. And when you were saying that you wanted to get out of here, you mean out of the country, out of the gatehouse, out of the...
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Just gone.
Gone.
Just
right?
gone.
Yeah. I get those coming up sometimes.
You know?
Me too.
And so I wanted to leave the audience with that thought. Well, my thought of showing that I actually know that I understand those feelings and... This is how I feel. This is how I react. I mean, if they knew what I'd done in the past, it wasn't pretty, but I did it anyway. And just acknowledging that the fact that I have is another story on itself. But just the fact that I'm aware is key and crucial for not doing these things.
Yes. Yeah, I think I always say this. How do we affect change in our lives? The first step is awareness of what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that's great, taking the pause, the mindfulness, and just allow. And here's a big one for me that I had to really train myself. Allow myself to whatever I'm feeling is okay and just process the emotions behind it. And so that was a big one. I was talking to somebody today about freezing.
Yeah.
And for me, I realized when I get into that freeze mode, it's my inner child. That's terrified again. So I do something simple like the grounding breathing with my mantra,
mm-hmm.
saying, you know, this is not then, this is now, I am safe, and
mm-hmm.
do that a few times. And
mm-hmm.
I'm able to then pause, be mindful, and know where it's come from, and then not do it.
And here's another great example of being mindful.
Yeah.
Of bringing yourself back, being present.
Yes.
And what you said was key, as I've been pointing out along, is being aware.
Yes.
You know, you can't practice these things if you're not aware of what you're thinking and feeling, right?
Can't affect change if you don't know yet.
If you don't know.
You're not aware of it, but you're doing it. So.
See, and this is where journaling comes in really, really handy. Keeping track of what your thoughts, whether you're in rage or whether you're in anger or you're sad or wherever you might be feeling at that time, and keeping track of those thoughts and feelings to whatever may have brought you to those feelings will help you to determine what the hell is going on, what you're thinking. And recognizing that, okay, when this happens, this is what I do.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
You know? And I think, like, for myself, I know a lot of times before I became aware of what I'm feeling and thinking or aware of what my body was doing and what it was telling me to do was I had to learn to be aware.
Yes, I agree.
You know? Yeah. And which took a bit of time.
you know, one of the things that really helped me along that way, because I had a hard time with that at first. Mm. And then I started concentrating on what am I feeling physically in my body?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I'd really do a check in there. And a lot of times is that burning in the stomach and that
mm-hmm.
nausea.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go back, well, when's the first time I felt that? And it would help me connect the dots of where I was triggered to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, then you say, so now there's the awareness. Mm-hmm. So I realize at that time, it's not me that's driving the bus right now, if I can say it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, that's
it's my
example.
Scared, terrified inner child.
Yeah.
And so being aware of that and then doing the breathing and doing that mantra and quieting him down. And then it's like, great, now I can have the, well, what do we say? We expand that space between
mm-hmm.
whatever you're feeling in action
mm-hmm.
until we can have a healthy response to it.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's really helpful.
And but one thing I like about you do is you practice Baba Jin.
Absolutely.
And
every day.
And I mean, that's just another component to your mindfulness, right?
Is absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that? That experience, how that affects you? Would you move your mind talking about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Especially when I call it discombobulated. So
mm-hmm.
I'm having emotions, and I'm not sure where they're coming from. So, and I'm not letting them take over me, right? But they're starting to. And so, whatever that emotion is, whatever I'm feeling. I want to take a pause, and sometimes it's hard. So I do a little regimen. I go out into the garden, and I just sit for a minute and just do some breathing. And then I get up, and I want to do a moving meditation, which is the Bagua Jin, which
mm-hmm.
is, again, all centered around breathing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it 2-3 times. And I tell you, by the time that third or second time, even time sometimes on the first time, I just feel completely centered again.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm centered. And now I can take a look at it again without it overwhelming me and let that emotion come through. And then sometimes I'll just sit with that emotion and just be with it, not judge it, not try to figure it out, just be with it. And then I may go back and do the Bagua Jin again, do some more grounding breathing. And, you know, on a very rare occasion too, I'll add walking the labyrinth in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, it's like I've never made it through the whole labyrinth without it all sort of revealed in front of me. And so I love that. Now, I don't just do the Bagua Jin when I feel like that. I start my day with it. I like to get up. I like to do the Bagua Jin a couple of times. So it's a moving meditation. It gets everything moving, gets the chakras open, get
mm-hmm.
everything and the energy going. That's the main thing. And it stabilizes my energy. And then I sit down and I do some grounding breathing. And then I practice gratitude.
Mm.
I say out loud all the things I'm grateful for. And then my day has started. And I tell you, for a while there, I wanted to try a little experiment because I was feeling really great. And so I stopped doing all that for 2 weeks. And I tell you, by the end of that 2 weeks, my emotions were in turmoil again.
Mm.
It was really affecting me. So I know when I want to feel centered, when I want to feel grounded, I go through my rituals every morning.
Mm.
I also offer it on Mondays to the groups, and I'll start offering it on Thursdays to the groups. We just had a couple new ones start, so
yeah.
But
yeah.
What I'll say to the facilitators is at 1:45, because the group starts at 7, well, I'll be in the garden and I'll be doing the Bagua Jin. I'll lead the Bagua Jin. So sometimes we have 8 or 9 people, sometimes it's just 2, sometimes it's just me. But I think it's a wonderful way to ground before groups as well.
And those that are not familiar with Bagua Jin, Bagua Jin is a form of Tai Chi.
Is it or is it Kung Fu?
Oh,
Tai Chi. So
Tai Chi,
yeah. I'm not really sure of it. I know
yeah.
that
yeah,
the Kung Fu master, Brad,
yeah. Yeah, well, yeah.
He always does it, and I've seen it.
Yeah.
So really, a lot of Kung Fu does that, too, because I've seen that on the...
Well, it's a form of Tai Chi.
But and they bring it into that.
Exactly.
Right?
It's all part of it. It's just another form of that.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the whole background of it,
yeah.
but I know I love it.
It Bagua Jin is a form, if you research it, you'll see it's a form of slow, controlled movements. That focuses on breathing and a technique of breathing and movement. It's
right.
all slow and controlled.
Yes.
And that's the idea behind it.
Yes.
Is to give you that self, that feeling of control for yourself.
Yes.
And that's why it's all slow. It's not. When you speed
no.
it up, it's deadly, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's a form of Tai Chi
yeah.
where you do slow, controlled movement.
Yes.
If you don't know what Tai Chi is, then Bagua Jin is a form of Tai Chi.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that education today. I'm going to have to start saying that in the, when I'm leading it now. I usually say, you know, Brad, our resident Kung Fu master, showed me this. And, and I'm not sure where it all came from. I know it's like 3,000 years old.
Yeah,
and
it's very, very old.
And it's about opening up meridians and chakras. Yeah. And all I know, and then I look at them and I say, but all I know is it really works for me. So, you know, that's great. What was I saying? And then, as I was saying earlier, we have a wonderful labyrinth here that was built last year. And I really find it very helpful. And in fact, sometimes when I'm doing a one-on-one with somebody, and we're sort of at, not an impasse, but we're at a real deep contemplative, not really sure what they're looking for, or they're not sure what they're hearing, or I go, let's go and just walk the labyrinth and contemplate that. And we walk it together in silence, and you know, one or two, and really, so it really helps you. I don't know what it is, if it's the repetitive going in the circle, but whatever that is, it works. It really does come to you, you know.
Well, anybody who's ever seen any pictures that I've put out there on Twitter or Facebook and, of the Healing Garden at the Gatehouse could really, really appreciate this. It's a beautiful place. It's easy to walk. Like, if you look at the grounds, if you were to Google the Gatehouse, for example, and Humber College, for example, well, the Gatehouse backs onto Humber College. And if you saw the whole property, it's beautiful, beautiful grounds. And we're basically we're basically right on Lake Ontario.
Yes.
So if you walk from the Gatehouse going south from where I am, I wouldn't expect you on the other end to understand where south is.
Yeah.
Or north. Really
south
north
of here,
Oh, no, I'm north. I'm from Canada, so I'm the opposite of north, but south to me. To Lake Ontario from here. It's just a short walk. It's about a 10-15 minute walk, but it's just beautiful grounds.
And,
and we're talking maybe 500 acres?
Probably,
yeah, about 500 acres. Or not quite a hectare anyway, or actually not a hectare, but
It takes about, like you say, I think it takes about 15, maybe 17 minutes to walk it from the north to the south to the lake,
But it's about 500 acres. It's a huge, huge property because they've got the park. It's down to the beach, and we've got two soccer fields.
Yeah.
And back there as well.
Yeah.
Is there baseball there too?
I haven't seen the baseball field.
But I know there's soccer and rugby because they practice.
Yeah.
Humber College and all the universities they all go down there and they practice and play.
I think one day when we were doing an assist.
They're rugby,
yeah, we watched them rugby all day.
So anyway, the point being is it's beautiful ground. So what Paul would make a reference to was the labyrinth. So if you were to Google it and you were to see, and I don't know whether Google Maps would show that or not. I don't know
if it's on since we just did it last year. Google Maps would have to, like, I think they just do pictures, don't they?
I'm not sure if it would be there. But anyway, if you were to go to Gatehouse website, you would see it from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I know with Google Maps, and if you do the visual, then when they drive, you might be able to see it as it's driving by.
I'm talking about the labyrinth, and maybe not everybody realizes what that is.
Yeah.
It's a maze.
Yeah, it's a maze.
That and you'll see a lot of them in the Parks and Rec, but they're painted onto the cement.
Yes.
Which is this one, we've actually used plants, and it's about, what would you say, ankle high or a little higher, maybe mid-shin.
Yeah.
So it's not like intrusive. You're not going, it's not like a maze, like the old mazes you see where they built up.
Well, it's not a maze, it's a labyrinth.
It's a labyrinth, absolutely. And it's, and you know, it takes about 20 minutes, I think. You walk in and it takes you through a bunch of maze-like things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you end up going through all the four quadrants. But the best thing is that it's kind of like, I don't know, it's soothing. It soothes you, and for me, walking it silently allows me to just really contemplate what's on my mind, to get in touch with those emotions, you know? And, of course, here at the Gatehouse, I've learned over time to not be afraid of whatever the emotion is, to just be with it. Don't judge it. Just be with it.
Yeah, be present with it and acknowledge it.
Yeah. Wonderful.
But, so that's been my evening.
Well, how about you feeling now about flight?
Oh, I'm happy to have talked about it. I'm still dealing with my, like, I don't really talk about it a whole lot. Yeah. I mean, I talk about it a lot, but I haven't really talked about it in the house a whole lot over the years. But in the last years, I've probably because I've progressed in my healing, but one thing hasn't is my body pain that I carry.
Right.
And it's in the last years, it's become more apparent. Probably because I'm aware of what I'm thinking and feeling now, and now it's probably starting to arise.
I guess when you allow the feelings that you have, then yeah. All of them come in.
Exactly,
sure.
Exactly. Gotcha. And I think really that's what's happened to me. But it's very hard because it's very hard in the body. It's so hard in the body.
Yeah.
You know, put you in another place you don't want to be.
Absolutely.
And then I need to apply the mindfulness. I need to be to
absolutely
sit back and relax, right? But it's not always that easy.
You know, a funny thing I was talking with somebody about that is we store emotional pain in our joints.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had knee problems since I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about 2 years after the abuse stopped. And, you know, I've had that knee pain my entire life. And I've gone and had it checked. I've had exploratory surgery on it. Nobody's ever been able to tell me what it is.
Mm. What about Deb?
Yeah, Deb. I was talking with Deb.
Talking with Deb Mayberry.
Yeah, wonderful. And we started discussing that. She made reference because she sees me constantly massaging the knees.
Yeah.
So she's the one who says that we store some of those emotions, some of that pain in that emotional pain in our joints. So I'm not sure. So that's great because now I'm going to be sort of mindful of when it's happening. And when I feel the flare ups, I'm going to start looking at what's going on with me. What am I feeling right now?
So is Deb helping you find ways to release that?
I hope so. Well, that'll be the next sessions that we together. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful person.
Because she has some wonderful techniques on how you can get rid of that body.
She told me about that, so we're going to try that.
So I would highly recommend that you do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe tapping is one way of going, and then there's other things you can do as well. I know she does as well.
That would be great, yeah. I'm really excited. You know, as the more that I go down my healing path, the more the journey is, and the more interesting and completely wonderful the journey is. So,
oh, definitely, definitely. It keeps becoming more and more interesting as we go along.
Does
learn new things.
Yeah. All right, so I should get back and do some more work.
Yeah, I'm going to sign off anyway, but thank you for bringing me your coffee.
Oh, anytime, absolutely. Coffee to order for you, sir.
Much appreciated.
And absolutely. And everybody out there, wonderful to talk with you. Thank you.
And really, thank you for sharing.
Oh, anytime. Anytime. It's one thing that I would say that I've gotten from the Gatehouse that is just a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ability to share my emotions and my feelings now. So, yay. Thanks, Stuart.
Anyway, thanks. My this was Paul Dunn, the coordinator, men's coordinator,
and the phase two coordinator.
So, and master of a bunch of other things.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, but we keep moving forward and offer support.
Anyway, we appreciate what you do here.
It's kind of what I said to somebody the other day. They said, you know, because we ended up staying late after a group because they needed some more support. And they were just like, you know, we stayed about a good hour.
Yeah.
And that person said, well, thank you so much for saying that. And I looked at him and said, hey, we're the Gatehouse. Support's kind of our gig. Yeah. Have a great one.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
How's the coffee?
Coffee's great.
Nice bud, eh?
Good bud.
All right, bro.
Thanks. Okay, folks, well, what can I say? Thank you for joining me, or if you join me later on, listen to this as this will be released as a podcast at as soon as I'm finished. I really hope that you got something out of this tonight or have a better understanding about the three forms of, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, and maybe you can relate to that in some way. Maybe you've experienced that. Maybe you've gone through that. Or going through that. I gave you some examples of myself of what I've been going through and the key thing I talked about but for myself is about being aware. By being aware, that's allowed me to do these other things to try to help myself. So folks, if you have the capacity or the ability to work on these things and if you don't and you're able to get some help to go and do it, then I highly encourage you to do so and helping you to move forward. What else can I say? Okay, well, I talked about our new program tonight, which we have started, the road from estrangement to reconciliation. Again, there's a new program which we started at the Gatehouse. In 6 weeks or 5 weeks, I'm going to have the two people that are running the program. I'm going to actually, I'll have to come in, get them to come in on, not on a Thursday, but on an odd day, and we'll do a podcast. Rather, I'll release it as a podcast, the interview with the two facilitators, and they will, what they'll do is I gave you an outlay of what the program consists of, which really doesn't tell you a whole lot, but it gives you an idea of what they're talking about or what they're going to be covering over the next 15 weeks. I'll have them come down, or rather I'll have them come in, and when they're here, and they'll talk about at a deeper level in regards to the topics that they're covering, and you'll have a deeper appreciation. So again, this is another new program at the Gatehouse. Kudos for the Gatehouse for doing this. Actually, kudos to the two ladies for doing that. Charmaine and Pat actually are the two ladies that devised this 15-week program. And I'm quite anxious to hear after debriefing tonight to hear how well it went. So folks, I'm going to bid you adieu. See you next week. I'm not sure if I'll have a guest or if I'll be on solo again, but I have a few people I'm waiting for some answers for in regards to coming on to appear as a guest in regards to therapists for different things. So self-care is really, really important. If you feel triggered in any way, talk to somebody, call Rain, call somebody, talk to somebody. Your self-care is most important. Folks, have a good night. Thank you for joining me and have a good week and happy summer. Good night.